Hi, everybody. I'm Jimmy. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober. And it's always been customary to introduce myself by letting you know I have a home group. It's called the Design for Living Group on the Jersey Shore. I have a spot.
It's all right.
It's not the West Side men's group, but. I've had a couple of conversations with you guys. Take it easy, you know? I have a sponsor. That's a good thing to have. A service sponsor. A sponsor a lot of men. But most importantly, I've been sober since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was on March 28, 1987. So extremely grateful. Thank you. Extremely. Let me set this. What did you say, Ben? 3 hours? Okay. Wait a second. Oh, there we go. Hold on. Somebody told me, oh, we have a big football game today at 12 o'clock, the Hurricanes. Who are they? I didn't even hear of them. Oh, did I hurt someone's feelings just now? Oh, forget it. I can't even work this thing. All right. So, thank you, group. Thank you for having me and my wife, Mary Beth, down here for the for this beautiful breakfast. Thank you, Ben, for the invite. Thank you for all you guys who have done all the hard work. You know, we had a conference last week in Jersey that we put on. We had 800 people in, so, you know, I know what it's like to put these things together, all the hard work. If it looks easy, it's all because of the hard work that goes behind this stuff, you know. And so I just really thank you, and I thank the guys who have taken us out last night, John and Sean and Bobby and Mike, and, you know, it was just a nice night out last night. It was funny, Sean leaned over to me at one point and says, "You're from Jersey." I said, "Yep." He goes, "You know any gangsters like Tony Soprano?" I said, "Sean, I'm from the Jersey Shore. I only know people like Snooki." You know. Now, as I look at some of your older faces, you're like, "Oh." So you're over 40, just lean into a young person. You don't know who that is. Again, I come from Jersey. I'll give you a little visual. Me and Mary Beth, we live 60 miles south of New York City on the Jersey Shore. Beautiful area. Locals, Chamber of Commerce, like to call it the Irish Riviera. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous like to call it Cirrhosis by the Sea. Great AA, great life. Matter of fact, I met a lot of you guys in here from Jersey and New York, you know, and kind of surprised. I always thought the Federal Witness Protection Program went west, not south. So, but it's good to see a lot of you guys and some familiar faces. I spoke here 2 years ago at Florida State in Fort Lauderdale somewhere. So I met a lot of you guys like Paul and all of a sudden, soft hand Vinny's. But that was the old days. Didn't we tag everyone with a nickname? I mean, everyone. Yeah. As you'll hear, I was Angry Jimmy for a while. But just great to be here, and, you know, just great to be here. So I always like to start my story off by letting you know that I was born perfect, and I was quickly handed over to these two character defects called Mom and Dad. And I make a joke out of that, but the truth of the matter is, isn't it their fault? I mean, it always has to be someone's fault, and that's just the way I was raised. It has to be someone's fault, and obviously, my parents were the first ones right out of the gate. It had to be their fault for whatever it was, you know, and all my parents ever tried to do was, you know, give me morals, values, a good education, and all I ever did for my parents was take all the goodness they ever gave me, rolled it into a nice ball, stuffed it down their throats, and introduced my parents to a way of life that they never even knew existed. You know, I'm 66 years old. I grew up in, well, the early 60s. You know, I grew up in a city across from the New York City on the Hudson River, a very tough neighborhood, a very blue-collar neighborhood. You know, I never saw a guy dressed like this going to work. I mean, everyone was a cop, a fireman, a warehouse worker. My old man was a butcher. You know, it was just a tough, tough neighborhood. It was a time when all the dads worked, all the moms stayed home. The only requirement for membership in the neighborhood was 5 or more kids. I mean, so it was always a lot of things going on, a lot of activity going on. And I got to tell you, from a young age, I thought that was the only place on the planet Earth was the neighborhood. We did everything in the neighborhood, you know, and it took me a few years to find out that there's other places to go. But I'm growing up in this neighborhood, and, you know, with all these kids, with all these things going on, there's always an occasion going on, right? There's always a birthday party, a christening, a graduation, you name it. And the thing that's at every event is King Alcohol. And again, as a young kid, 6, 7, 8 years old, my relationship with alcohol, my perception of alcohol, we hear that line all the time, the disease of perception. The way I would look at alcohol is that I would equate alcohol with fun. You know, I would equate alcohol with freedom. I would equate alcohol, it seemed like problem solved, right? It looked like for me, from a young guy, kid's eyes, that when you guys drank, it looked like everything was cool. You know, my old man, my uncles, the neighbors, they would sit down and just start drinking. Yeah, was there fist fights up? Yeah, there were. But, you know, let's push that to the side. It was always looked like it was a good deal to do, you know? And I got this guy called Dad. You know, he's cunning, he's baffling, he's powerful. Yeah, I'm one of those guys that grew up in AA with daddy issues. You know, thank God that was resolved, and I'll talk about that. But my old man was a tough guy. My old man was, you know, if we look back, if we diagnose my father today, you know, he had PTSD from whatever war he was in back then. He was just a guy that didn't show any emotions. He was a guy that was just tough around, you know, around the edges. He was a guy that never talked really about anything. We never had fireside chats about the life, about life or anything like that. My dad was a great provider, put 5 of us through major universities in the United States. But my dad was just a guy that was really hard to, you know, deal with. And but my dad would, you know, every day, 5 o'clock, like clockwork, my dad would, my mom would make these 2 pitchers, one called martinis, the other one called Manhattans. And what I would witness is the ease and comfort that comes at once by taking that first drink. Because my old man would take that first drink, and all of a sudden, the hard guy became soft. The hard guy became a guy that wanted to have a catch in the backyard. The guy that wanted to, you know, be with his family. The guy that had a few jokes once in a while, which was shocking. He just became a different person because of what alcohol did for him. And but don't let me fool you. There were those days. And those days looked something like this. My old man would take that first drink, and all of a sudden, the kitchen plates would be flying across the kitchen. Kitchen chairs would be flying across the kitchen. If you grab one of us young kids, we'd be flying through the kitchen. So it wasn't uncommon in my house at 5:05 every night, you know, that me and my 2 brothers and 2 sisters would be hiding under the sheets or hiding under the covers of our beds, waiting for the tornado to roar through the house. And then when the tornado roared through the house, we'd walk out, and, you know, it's the old line in the book, you know, nothing to matter here, Mom, the wind stopped blowing, right? We would never discuss what went on. We'd never talk about my father's anger. We'd never talk about the broken dishes. We'd never talk about the bent chairs or the slaps or the violence or the things that went on in my house. It was just pushed under the rug. And none of that makes me alcoholic, you know? But it makes me a kid that grows up with a tremendous amount of fear. Fear of loud noises, fear of anger, fear of violence, fear of authority, fear, 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 the evil and corroding threat. I'm a kid that wakes up or grows up with a lot of inadequacy and insecurity about myself. It wasn't like I ever got like these motivational talks from my old man that I could do whatever I wanted to do in this world. It was just shut up and sit down, stupid, you know, that type of thing, right? Never anything that was encouraging or any of that went on. But worst of all, I'm a kid that grows up with a lot of secrets. Because you see, if you come from my family, you come from my house, you don't talk about what's going on in your house and you don't talk about what's going on in your family. Matter of fact, you don't even talk about what's going on in your neighborhood. That's a snitch, right? So you learn, or I learn, to internalize every feeling I ever had, right? Push that stuff down, never see the light of day, walk around life believing that my secrets are going to the grave with me about what goes on in my home, right? Then that day came. 13 years old. I believe we all have a moment when life changes or puts us on another course, right? I'm in 5th grade. I'm in a public school system. I'm with a lot of friends. We play a lot of ball in the schoolyards back then. I have the sense of ease and comfort that goes on in my life. I have a feeling of togetherness rather than separateness. And I'm with all my friends, and my parents make a decision for me that I thought was against me, but really it was they wanted better for me. And they took me out of the public school system where I knew everyone, and they put me across town into a Catholic school system where I knew nobody. So the square peg in a round hole shows up. And all of a sudden, I'm that kid that, you know, I meet these other cunning, baffling, powerful people. We call them nuns. And you know, and if you're from the 60s and you have those kind of nuns, you know exactly what I'm talking about, you know? Any of them could play in the NFL. I mean, they were, you know, that's the type of people, the women they were, right? You know, and so this course of life that I get pushed onto, you know, I'm 13 years old. I'm in the Catholic school system. And I finally found myself in a cemetery with 5 guys that I know to this day, 53 years ago, and I'm about to have my first drink. And I'm in the cemetery, and we're in a circle, and I'll never forget it. This first bottle of Colt 45 comes around. And I put my hand in there with a tremendous amount of fear, and I grabbed the neck of that bottle, and I start drinking on a cold 45 malt liquor. Here comes that second bottle. It's called Mohawk Blackberry Brandy, and I start drinking on that Blackberry Brandy. And what I can tell you about my first night drinking is I blacked out. I puked purple for about 2 weeks. I took a beating from my father, and my mother apparently grounded me for life. But the hook was in, the magic elixir, the thing that works for everyone in this room if you're an alcoholic. The thing that just settled down that thing. And I don't know what that thing is, but there's something going on inside of me. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would hear you old timers say things like this, that alcoholism is a soul sickness caused by a separation from God and a disconnect from each other. And by the time I'm 13 years old, I'm already building walls. I'm the chameleon. I'm pretending to be someone you want me to be. And, you know, and I don't even know I'm doing this stuff, right? I want to be accepted. I want to be part of. I want to be with these new friends. But, you know, what I didn't realize on that first day drinking, I just stepped on a path that goes straight to pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And if you don't know what that means, new friends, that means hell. Now, that doesn't mean that every time I drank, it was a lot of trouble. And every time that, you know, I got in trouble, you know, it was because of drinking. But it's just that my life over the next 16 years turned into full-blown alcoholism and homeless on the streets of northern New Jersey. You know, and I grew up in a time when, you know, my mom would open up the door at 8 o'clock in the morning. She'd boot us all out. She knew we'd all come home eventually. Like, that's just the way it was back then. You knew you'd eat somewhere. You know, I'm not too bright. You'll find that out pretty soon. You know, I like to say lack of education, you know. But, you know, I'm the type of guy, let's put it this way. I'm the type of guy, my buddy Pete's right here, you know. He's a Brooklyn guy, you know. If you grabbed me and Peter and put us on a street corner and then drove by and said, hey, there's a dead bird, me and him would both look up. I like to pull him into that all the time. I'll let that sink in. But that's really what happened. So not only does my drinking very quickly become progressive, my behavior starts to be progressive, and that's the point, you know. All of a sudden, criminal activity, doing the things that we do on the streets to survive on the streets. You know, my dad and my brothers and, you know, people of authority who I like or teachers, none of them were my heroes. My heroes were like this neighborhood bookie. You know, that guy, he had a nice car, he had a nice girl, always had a wad of cash. That's the kind of guy I wanted to be inspired to be. I wanted to be a street guy, you know. And, you know, it's never like my parents ever sat me down and, oh, this is how you rob a car or this is how you get a freight train or any of that. It just became a way of life on the streets, you know. And, you know, there was no shame attached to that growing up. That's just the way it was. You know, now looking back all that time, yeah, there's a lot of shame attached to that. But I got right with a lot of that stuff because of the amends process, you know. So, you know, just to give you a couple of little stories about where I was at, you know, in my drinking, you know, I mean, the drinking age in New Jersey back then was 18 years old. But, you know, if your chin could hit a bar, the top of a bar, you were getting served. I've been 6'4" since birth. So, you know, I mean, you know, so I get on, you know, I'm getting served at 15, 16 years old in little shot and beer, old man bars, you know. And that just became a way of life. And little by little, you know, I started to become a daily drinker by the time I'm 18 years old. And I'm not drinking to get loaded every day. The alcoholic life just seems the normal one. I'm hanging with guys that are doing the same thing as me, and it just became a way of life. You know, I go to this, like I said, my parents always wanted me to have a good education. I go to this Jesuit prep school, you know, and my mother's the secretary to the principal. Thank the good Lord on that one, you know. And I'm in this Jesuit, in this prep school, and one day a priest walks up to me and he starts to have a little bit of a discussion with me, gets a little heated, and before you know it, I knock the priest out. I didn't go to hell right away. Take it easy. And I don't say that for a laugh. I just say that that's a part that I earmark. That's a day that I earmark. I'm 17, 18 years old. Faced with anyone, faced with any situation, faced with anything. The way I dealt with life back then was I either got angry at it or I drank at it. I didn't know how to deal with human emotions. I didn't know how to hang out. I didn't know how to deal with human affairs, you know, so I would always be violent. I would always take it out on you. I'd always blame you. I'd be angry. I'd be violent, you know, and I'm not proud of that. It's just that's who I became. You know, and so, you know, I go through all that stuff and, you know, go on to the greatest 10 years of my life. That's called college. You know, I have a great time out in Pennsylvania, 9 friends. You know, and what I don't see is what most of us don't see. I don't see the progression of my alcoholism. You know, I don't see that every day my whole life revolves around drinking. I don't see that every decision I'm making revolves around drinking. I'm just on this path of destruction, and I don't even know I'm on this path of destruction. You know, I'm like in my early 20s. All my friends seem to be wearing life like a loose garment. They seem to be getting jobs in New York City. They're making big money. They got her. They buy the house with the white picket fence. And I'm a guy that comes back from Pennsylvania or college where I came from, and I don't know what to do with my life. I don't know what to do with my life. So my life begins a daily thing of going down to the corner bar at 8 o'clock in the morning and trying to figure out my life. I don't know how many people in here are trying to figure out their life, but, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old, I'm trying to figure this out. And what I don't understand about going down to the corner bar at 8 o'clock in the morning is I'm taking that first drink. I don't understand the concept that the first drink gets you loaded. I don't learn that until I come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I hear you guys tell me that the first time, I don't even believe that's true because I think it's the last 20. I think it's the outside issues. I think it's all that stuff that's getting me drunk. I have no idea it's a first drink gets me drunk. So week after week, month after month, year after year, doing little side jobs, doing this, trying to hustle, trying to make some money. I'm just a regular corner bar guy. You know, that's all I do. And I'm trying to figure out my life. And as I watch everyone move on with their life, you know, I'm that double-edged sword guy. I'm the guy that's blaming everyone for the way I feel, what's going on in my life. I want to point fingers at you. I want to point fingers at her, my parents, you name it. I got to point fingers because I can't take stock, honestly, of the way I am and where I am in my life by the time I'm 22, 23 years old, right? But I'm also the guy that's always seeking, searching for something out there because there has to be something out there that's going to fix this thing inside of here. And whether that's women or drugs or alcohol or cars or whatever materialistic thing, I am convinced I'm under the delusion because that's what alcoholism is. It's, as I've heard a million times, it's not some alcoholism doesn't come in a bottle. It comes in my mind, and my mind is filled with a lot of delusions and distortions. And I am truly believing that if I get just something out there, we'll fix this in here, I'm going to be okay. But little do I know that King Alcohol has me in its grips. And year after year goes by. And I'm in a bar one day, and I see a girl against the back wall. And the way I used to do relationships was I would, you know, grab my little sister and say, introduce me to this woman. She would. I'd buy her an illegal substance. And this is what happened. 7 months later, I get married. I'm 25 years old or 26 years old. I don't remember how old I was. And I jump into a marriage because I'm under the delusion that if I just get married, my life will be okay. I think this is going to solve all my problems. I don't even think drinking's a problem. I just think I have a life problem. I equate my alcoholism with circumstances. If I just get this stuff in, if I get all my ducks in a row, I'm going to be okay. And I jump into this marriage, and 4 months into this marriage, I walk out of this marriage because I have the inability not to take that first drink. And I jump into this marriage, and I pretend to be a married guy. I don't like her. I don't like me. I'm irresponsible. I'm non-caring. I could barely hold a job. But I walk into this marriage thinking that this is going to solve my problem. And what happens is I walk out of the marriage 4 months into the marriage. I'm an everyday drunk at this point in my life. And I take off on this woman. I just walk her. I leave the family flat. That's it. And I come down here to Boca Raton, Florida. And my family, a friend of mine's family had a nice condo on the water. I'll never forget this day. I'm in that condo. I'm getting a knock at a fellow horseman. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. Somewhere along the lines, God cracked my skull open. And on this, and in my mind, he put this chalkboard of emotions, of shame, guilt, and remorse. And it seems as though everything I've been doing in my life up to the age of, let's just say, 26, 27 years old has created some sort of shame, some sort of guilt. Shame of not being a good son, shame of failing out of college, shame of losing jobs, shame of walking out of marriage, shame, shame, shame. Most alkies have shame-based identities, and I'm riddled with it, and I'm filled with it. I don't know that until I come to meet you fine folk. The guilt of the things I'm doing, the remorse of the people I'm hurting, it's controlling my life. But you see, I have an answer. We call that Johnny Walker Red, and all I need to do is crack the seal of the bottle, and all of a sudden that grandiosity comes back. All of a sudden, it's your fault for the way I feel. It's her fault for the way I feel. And that little baby that was born perfect comes out to play. It's everyone else's fault for the way I feel. And that's where I'm at 27 years old. And I make a decision. I make a decision to come back to New Jersey. And I'm a coward. I'm a coward like a lot of us are cowards. I don't want to face the music. I don't want to look at my life. I don't want to see any of the things I've done. I don't want to see the destruction I left behind. So I come back to New Jersey making a decision that let me just camp out a little bit and figure out my life. So I'll stay on the streets for, you know, a couple of days. And those couple of days turned into 19 months of living on the streets of northern New Jersey and lower Manhattan, living that life. As he would say, and he told me many years ago, you know, one night on the streets is just one night too many for any of us. And when you live on the streets, you know, and I know a lot of people haven't lived on the streets, but that's a different kind of thing altogether, you know, traumatic, dehumanizing, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. If I took a basketball, made a glass right now, just threw it down on the ground and it was shattered, that was my life at the age of 29 years old. My life was shattered and I had no idea that alcohol was even part of that. It was all circumstantial stuff. Me and my wife were in Los Angeles last month at a deal, and a friend of ours works at the Midnight Mission, where Clancy used to work, and we got a tour of the Midnight Mission. And since Skid Row, if any of you have been in Los Angeles, you know what that, you know, it's the only place I know on this earth that, you know, it goes from Technicolor to black and white just walking into those streets at Skid Row. I mean, it's bad. And, you know, I've gone through a lot of therapy. I've had to do a lot of work on living on the streets and how it almost destroyed me. But I'll tell you, we're taking this tour, and at one point we walked to like a balcony, and the woman who's giving us the tour points to all these high rises, and she goes, "That's where all the billionaires live. All high towers of finance." And then she said, "And that's where most of us live." And I looked down off this balcony, and it was Tent City. And people were just walking around, hopeless, dying. And I caught a guy that was stumbling down the street. And this is the first time in over 30-something years that I thought of me when I was stumbling down the street. The aimless walk. No purpose in life. No goals in life. Alcohol had me in its grip. Didn't know it had me in its grip. Didn't understand why I'm living on the streets. I wasn't raised that way. Don't understand why I'm going through the things I'm going through. I don't understand anything about alcoholism until I land with you fine folk and you sit me down. And that was really a moment of clarity for me that this is where I came from. And I'm not rich in any way, but I'm rich in fellowship. I'm rich with friendships. I'm rich with sobriety. I'm rich with Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't need a lot of money. I'm happy right where I'm at today. And that's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous and what we've done for each other in these rooms. So it was really a telling moment. So what happened was, living on the streets, you know, I walk in a bar one day and I see this old timer I know from the neighborhood. And he comes up to me and goes, "Hey, Jimmy, you know, they're hiring guys like you at Newark Airport." Finally being seen for my potential. I always wanted to fly a plane. I just didn't know how to do that, you know? So back in the day, there was an airline, and you guys probably know, you're in Florida. I think it's the only destination I had was Florida. Was People's Express. That's when the flights were $69 to Florida. Now it's like $10,000 to get to Florida. And, so they were hiring guys like us to hopefully get the luggage that's over there onto the plane over there. Now, I like to segue all the time, just let you know that if you flew through Newark Airport in the 80s and you're still waiting for your luggage, I'll make amends after this talk. But here I am, you know, the next day, me and two guys, we rob a car. We're all sober now over 37 years. We all made amends to that guy. It's pretty funny. But we take a car and we go out to Newark Airport. And I walk into a room that is as big as this. Now, I'm dirty. I'm filthy. I have a big beard. I had hair back then. I mean, you know, every other word's a grunt out of my mouth. Like, I'm now in the grunting stage like my father. "How you doing, Jimmy?" Oh, like, that's how I talk. No vocabulary. I'm just a broken street guy, you know, And what happens is we go into this room and the guy calls us in individually and, you know, here is the interview process. "Can you lift the suitcase?" "Yeah, you're hired." I mean, that was it. So I walk out of this room and I am so, like, shot out, you know, and I sit in a chair just like Barbara's sitting up here, and I sit down and, man, I could feel the wind blowing through the hole of my soul. I couldn't tell you how I felt on that day. Wasn't until I landed in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and eventually opened up that blue book. When I opened that blue book, I read a story about a co-founder named Bill Wilson. And on page 8 of that book, Bill describes his first step experience, which I really believe describes all our first step experiences, when he says, "No words could tell the loneliness and despair I felt in a bit of morass of self-pity. quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I met my match, been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And at the age of 29 years old, sitting in the middle of Newark Airport, I think drinking's a problem. Now, a blind man can see that. But aren't we the last ones that always see what goes on in our lives? And as I sit in that chair, all of a sudden, a complete stranger sat next to me. And after a couple of minutes, this complete stranger looked at me and said, "What's your problem?" Now, people weren't asking me how my 401k was doing or my that new Porsche I just bought. None of that. "What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you?" And I spit my life story up on this guy in about 10 minutes. And after I tell my little tale of woe, he looks at me and says, "I have the solution for you." And I said, "What's that?" He goes, "Is it possible for you not to take a drink the rest of this day?" I said, "I'm going to drink right now." I was honest with the guy. I didn't know who I was honest with the guy. "I want to drink right now. It's like 10 o'clock in the morning." He goes, "Where do you live?" I said, "Wherever I could put my head down." He pulled out a piece of paper. "Yes, there was a time, kiddies, that we didn't have cell phones and beepers." It's this white thing, like, and it's this yellow number two. And he pulled out a pencil, and he wrote down a street. "Do you know where this street is?" I said, "That's my old neighborhood." Put a number in front of that street. He said, "Try not to drink today and be in front of this house at 7 o'clock tonight." But for the grace of God, at 7 o'clock that night, I'm standing in front of this address. My knees are knocking, my stomach is churning, my mind is telling me a million and one stories, when all of a sudden a 1979 Chevy Impala pulls up. And the stranger's driving the car, and there's a bunch of other strangers in the car. And they rolled up on me, and yes, we used to roll down the windows. That's why we had big biceps back then. You know? They rolled down the window, and they said the most spiritual thing you'll ever hear in Alcoholics Anonymous: "Get in the car." Get in the car. And I got in the car with these gentlemen, and they took me around the corner to my grammar school, less than 500 yards away. And I got in the car with these guys, and I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was on March 28, 1987. And I've been here ever since.
Wow.
And, you know, I walked down those stairs. Every Catholic school in America is painted battleship gray. I could still smell that paint in my nose, you know. I walked down that staircase, and I'm going down to the meeting hall at the end of the room, at the end of the school, and I looked into the cafeteria. What happened to me? Because that's the cafeteria that I was a sixth grader, a seventh grader, an eighth grader. Goals, dreams, aspirations. I wanted to be somebody. I really did. Didn't understand the grip that alcohol had on me. Didn't know any of that stuff yet. But I wanted to be somebody. I didn't want to be a union worker, like my old man and like the guys in the neighborhood. Even though I became a union worker and had a very good career doing what I did. I just wanted something. And maybe that was attached to something external that I thought was going to make me feel better. But I just remember looking into that cafeteria. I started to walk down to the end of the hall, and I could smell coffee in the air. And that's being very generous. You know, back in the old, you old-timers, you know, maybe some of you mid-aged guys, you know, there used to be a coffee in Alcoholics Anonymous called Sanka. And, you know, I don't know. That's something that the astronauts drank on the moon with Tang. I don't know what that stuff was, but for the sake of the story, Sanka, I mean coffee, you know. And I woke up and I met the most important person you'll ever meet in Alcoholics Anonymous. We call him the greeter. And that gentleman put his hand out to me, and I grabbed that flimsy reed, and he pulled me into you. And what I understand today and what I know today to my heart is that's the loving and powerful hand of God. And he brought me into you. And the gentleman gave me something that I think we're all responsible to give anyone that shows up to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He gave me a piece of dignity that night. He didn't care what I looked like. He didn't care that I smelled. He didn't care that every other word was a profanity out of my mouth. "Come on in, kid. Get a half a cup of coffee. Sit up front because you'll hear the speaker a lot better than if you sat in the back." And my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous starts. And that guy that 12 set me in Newark Airport became my sponsor on that night. And that meeting was my home group on day one. So I had a sponsor and I had a home group on day one. They took away the interview process, you know. And this guy, Richie, became my sponsor. And, you know, I always like to talk about the kindness of strangers, the things that the men did for me in those early days. I'll never forget it, you know. You know, I joke around that those guys didn't know the difference between a phone book and a big book. But if you needed help, those guys would be on your front porch. Those guys carried themselves in a way that reflected recovery. Guys that were willing to go to any lengths to help anyone. Yeah, they couldn't quote the book. Yeah, they didn't tell you about a four-column inventory. They didn't do any of that stuff. They just showed up. They just showed up and did things for me that I could never do for myself. And that first night, they put me in a motel for a week. They went to an old department store in New Jersey. It's called Two Guys. And they went and they bought me jeans, T-shirts, and sneakers. And they put me up in a hotel for a week. They took their own money. They didn't take basket money. They did their own money to pay for me so I'd be okay. And I'll never forget day two, because on day two, I shed an emotion. That sounds kind of weird, right? I shed an emotion. You see, if you're like me, anything like me, you're shut down emotionally. You're shut down in every possible way. I don't know how to have human conversations. I don't know how to have grown-up conversations. I don't know how to talk about how I feel because I'm a guy who just pushes everything down, right? And I live by the street, the code of the street. You don't talk about how you feel, no matter what, right? And this guy, Richie, pulls up, and I say something that I'm even surprised comes out of my mouth. I tell him I'm scared. You don't say that kind of stuff where I come from. I'm scared. Why are you scared, Jimmy? Because I want to drink right now. And what I witness is what a trusted servant does in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he called up his wife, said, take me off the calendar. I'm going to be with a newcomer. He took me to three meetings that day, fed me three times. Must have drank 700 cups of coffee that day. But I felt like a part of you for the first time in my life. I felt like there was something connected to you. There was this umbilical cord that was going on. And all of a sudden, not that I knew what was going on, but I just felt something different in my life that I've never felt before. And that really starts my journey. You know, day seven. Why do I remember these days? It was like 30-something years ago. Why do I remember it? Day seven. I'm in my new home group with my new sponsor, with my new friends. I don't know what the hell's going on. I am what we used to call in the old days, mocus. Now, I don't know what that word means, but it sounds like a real good description of where I was at 7 days. And what happens is this Richie, he's doing jumping jacks in front of me. We're having a business meeting. What? A business meeting? And I want you to take the job as the ashtray cleaner. I'm like in my head saying, you're out of your mind. I'm not cleaning ashtrays. And I had a perfectly good reason, because to this moment right now, I've never smoked a cigarette in my life, never smoked a cigar in my life. I've never smoked, so why do I have to clean ashtrays? I didn't understand what he was trying to do for me, right? I thought he was doing something to me. And what he was trying to do for me was get me in the middle of the herd, to get me connected to you, to have a responsibility, to have a job. And what I could tell you is I listened to that small voice that we all have inside, that intuitive thing. And that thing said, trust the guy. He's trying to help you. He's not trying to hurt you. And from that moment to this moment right now, 37 months, or really 13,741 days for our day counters, one day at a time. I've been connected to Alcoholics Anonymous through a commitment, whether it's been in my home group, whether it's been in my district, whether it's been in my area. I've had a job in AA. You know, that third side of the triangle, that third legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous, of service, carrying a message to the best of our ability. So that really just starts this journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I eventually get back with that wife. Do you believe it? I got back with this wife. I mean, you know, when I saw her I was probably 4 months sober, and I ran into her, and I was telling her, I'm sober and all. She goes, that's good. And my mind says, should I move home? I haven't seen you in 2 years, but can I move home? You know how we think sometimes. You know, I think I'm ready. I'm back. The new and improved Jimmy's back, you know. Well, we eventually did get back together, you know, and we had that, you know, we had the house with the white picket fence. I got a great job. I had my first bank account. We had two little AA babies who were now 35 and 32. Externally, it looked like my life was on the fast track to happiness, right? To the untrained eye, it looks like normal living is a solution to alcoholism. I think because I attained stuff, I think because I got stuff, I think because I got her with a job or had children, that I'm going to be okay. And at 5 years without a drink, I got a rope. I just need a bridge to jump off. Because I'm dying of something I don't even know what I'm dying of. I'm dying of something we're not talking about in my home group. I'm dying of this thing called untreated alcoholism, as I heard earlier this today. And I'm not treating it with anything. I'm just treating it with not drinking and going to meetings. Now, that's very important. We know that. But I'm not changing. I got a belly full of fear, just like that 8-year-old. I got a belly full of insecurities, just like that 8-year-old. And I certainly got a belly full of secrets, just like that 8-year-old. And I'm not discussing any of that stuff with anyone, because I'm under the delusion, again, that abstinence is a solution to a spiritual malady. I think just not drinking, I'm going to be okay. And at 5 years without a drink, I'm not okay. I'm not okay at all. You know, and I had these God moments growing up, or I should say my early sobriety. I like to tell this story. I was 18 months sober. this guy that I had daddy issues with. We always banging heads, always fighting with each other, violent at times. Something happened when I met you. Something happened to my father when I brought him home to you. Something happened to my old man when I would talk about you guys and what I heard in meetings and, you know, not to break your anonymity, but just the fellowship that was going on in my life that he never heard of, because all he knew was a kid that was living on the streets. And when I would bring Alcoholics Anonymous home to my home and talk about you, something happened in my old man. That was like the residual effect. And all of a sudden, my old man got a little softer. Maybe that was with age, maybe what that was, but all of a sudden, things were okay. And at 18 months sober, I find my father dead right on the floor, right in front of me. I walk into my parents' home, and there he is. How do you deal with that at 18 months sober? Finding your father or a parent or anyone die in front of you. And I'll never forget, you know, I call my sponsor up. Now, at that time in Alcoholics Anonymous, 12-step calls were like a common occurrence. It was not uncommon not to go out to grab a drunk out of his house at any time of the night during a week and bring him to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Carry a pint of whiskey in your glove compartment so you can walk him off the ledge in case he's ready to go, right? And so I call my sponsor up, and all of a sudden, you know, he says, call 911, let's pray. I can't pray, I'm crying. He's praying, dad's there. All of a sudden, the first cop shows up. First cop's taking the information down, looks at me, says, I don't see you walking the streets anymore. I said, yeah, I don't do that anymore. A little bit more information, looks at me, says, matter of fact, I don't even see you drinking on a street corner or any in the bars or anything. I go, yeah, I don't do that either. He goes, well, how do you do that? I said, well, I go to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 18 months sober, and apparently it's working. I don't know much more to tell you. And all of a sudden, this cop starts talking about his drinking to me over my father's dead body. I am wide awake to the call of an alky. I've done enough 12-step. Even in those early years, I've done enough 12-step calls to understand what this guy's saying to me. This guy has a drinking problem. He doesn't know how to stop. And I wind up 12-stepping this cop over my dead father's body. Fast forward, I'm in my home group last year. Get a tap on my shoulder. We have a big home group. Looks like this. This is my home group right here. This is how big we are. And I get a tap on my shoulder, and I turn around. And there's a gentleman standing in front of me, and I don't know who he is. And he goes, you remember me? I said, no, kind of look at me. I don't know who you are. He goes, I've been looking for you. So what do you mean? He goes, well, I heard you moved out of the city, and I moved out of the city, and I knew you were an AA, and, you know, I just came here to look for you because I need to tell you something. I said, what's that? He goes, that next day after you had that conversation with me, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm here to let you know that I've been sober 34 years since that day. Wow. So, don't clap. That's you guys. Because I don't have the power to get anyone drunk. I don't have the power to get anyone sober. But guess what? God will use you without your permission. And my first spiritual truth came to me, that in order to get out of the darkness of my life, I need to serve others. Or as the old timers would say, I need a drunk not to drink, right? I need a drunk not to drink. And it was so important in that moment. What I was going to drink over my old man? I don't know. Maybe I was. I don't know. But God knew exactly what God had needed to do. He put a man in front of me that I was able to get separate from the emotion of what was going on, have a conversation about you, and all of a sudden, boom, here we are. Here we are. So life goes on, you know, like I said, I'm 5 years sober, and, you know, I'm at a podium like this. I'm, you know, giving a talk on the second step. I'm lying to every one of you because I'm paralyzed by what you think of me. You know, I'm talking on the second step. I have no relationship with God, even though I'm a Catholic and I believe in God, but I'm not accessing that power on a regular basis, you know. So I read the 12 and 12. I could tell some jokes if I need to. And at the end of the meeting, everyone comes up, shakes your hand. Good job, good job. Guy walks up to me. I'm 6'4". He's 6'4". Looks at me eyeball to eyeball, goes, you're screwed. And I want to start a fist fight in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I don't know how to face confrontation without violence. I don't know how to face, as he used to say, you know, resistance without resistance. I don't know how to deal with the human emotion. I have a normal conversation. That sounds bizarre, but that's where I'm at 5 years without a drink. But I take a step back, and God does for me and does for us what I could never do for myself. I look at this gentleman in the eyes, and I said, you're right. I need help. And that next day, I find myself in a railroad room apartment. You don't know what a railroad room apartment is? They built them in the New York area back after World War I. Long apartments that looked like train cars. And everyone from your family lived in this one apartment. So you had grandma, you had the uncles, the aunts, the cousins, the brothers, the sisters. And this guy that confronted me, he's in there, and he has a Jack Russell. Anyone know what a Jack Russell is? Jack Russell's like a newcomer on 40 cups of coffee. This dog was running the walls. He was running around. And this guy's peppering me with a few questions. First question, Jimmy, how long could you hold your breath? How long can you hold your breath? How long can you be in a 12-step program, not worth the 12 steps? What does your relationship with God look like? I believe in God, but what does God have to do with this? What makes you alcoholic? And the best I could stammer out of my mouth in that moment was I drank too much. No idea about the physical allergy, no idea about the mental obsession, no idea about the search engine deep down in all of us, that thing that just drives everything, the pipeline to the mind. I don't know all of that stuff. And he said to me something some of you guys might not believe, but this is the way it was in my neighborhood back then. He looks at me, goes, where's your big book? And I looked at him and said, what's a big book? I'm sure they were on a literature table. I'm sure they were at a podium or a lectern. But we were never encouraged to open a book back then. It wasn't until Joe and Charlie came through the Northeast in the 90s that we, you know, everyone got fired up and became militant in a way. You know, we all went through that stage. But, you know, we started to use the book like a weapon rather than a tool, right? Then he gave me a consideration. He said, Jimmy, if AA works, why do you have so many problems? Well, truth of the matter is, I'm not working AA, I'm just not drinking, going to meetings, and dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened on this particular day, this guy, Bill Grace, from St. Paul, Minnesota, same place where my sponsor comes from today, blue book underneath his arm, a man of depth and weight, carrying a message. He was on with the facts about himself, carrying his message, sat me down, and my life started to change on this particular Saturday afternoon. On this particular Saturday afternoon, this gentleman painted me so far into the corner, not only on my drinking, but my behaviors, that I had no choice but to take one of those two alternatives, spiritual life or spiritual death. Jimmy, keep doing what you're doing, trying to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, or really ask God for help. Ask God for help. And he started to talk about, you know, he made it really easy for a guy like me. He started to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. He would say things like this to me, Jimmy, AA has two goals, only two goals. And this was his belief, kind of my belief today. First goal, the obvious one, don't pick up the first drink. But it's the second goal that we all want to attain, and that's to have a relationship with God, to step out into the sunlight of the Spirit, to have this new way of living, you know, this place, the sunlight of the Spirit, this place he would talk about. This place where the bondage of self gets removed. This place where you'll experience freedom. This place where you'll experience all the promises that are laid out in our book. This place where you'll find God. And more importantly, as Bill Wilson would play, it's the perfect place. It's called Utopia. But in order to step out into the sunlight of the Spirit, you need to walk through the darkness of your life and uncover, discover, and discard the things that are blocking you from that. We took every chair, every table, and put it against that door back there. We would have to take actions to get outside. And that's what he was telling me. We need to take actions. One of the greatest readings, I read it all the time because I think it's just so simplistic in what we need to do. And if you opened up your book or the Daily Reflections and turned to May 1st, read the second paragraph, it says, it's a side of myself that I refuse to look at that rules me. I must be willing to look at the dark side in order to heal my mind and my heart, because that's the road to freedom. I must walk into darkness to find the light. I must walk into fear to find peace. And as the old timers would say, Alcoholics Anonymous, like a big bonfire. A lot of us are walking around the fire. But if you really want to change, if you really want to grow, if you really want a relationship with God, you have to walk through that fire and get your ass burnt and feel the uncomfortability of change. Spiritual warriors walk towards their problems. The pain that everyone in this room exhibits or feels is when we resist change, when we allow God to do for us what we can never do for ourselves. One of the most important things I ever heard was, I have to quit playing God. Why? It doesn't work. That's why. And that I can't control life, that I have to let go and let God. Now, that sounds very simplistic standing at a podium, but when the rubber hits the nail, can I really do that? Can I really, you know, access that power at any moment in my life and to really just let go and let God? I think that's the goal, right? Living life on life's terms, or even better yet, living life on God's terms rather than Jimmy's terms, right? I think I could just click my heels, read 414 or 449, 417, accept my situation and think everything's going to be great. No, I got to take actions. There are actions I need to take. And that's why I got a sponsor. That's why I have these steps. That's why I have a powerful God in my life, because I have to tap into that inner resource in order to get free. And so this is what really started to happen to me. And I'll never forget doing that second step with him, really talking about my misconception of power, to be willing to open my mind, right? We had that set-aside prayer, lay-aside prayer, a lot of different variations of that prayer. But the bottom line on the prayer is, let me set aside everything I think I know about, not only God, but everything, right? And to have this new experience, to see new truth about Jimmy. And to uncover, discover, and discard, be willing to go into the darkness of my life and to look at the things that are killing me, right? Really simple stuff, as I say. Faced with that stuff, it becomes paramount to some of us. But I sat with this guy, Bill Grace. We talked about some of the things that need to come down, the walls that I built, the walls of alibis, the walls of excuses, the walls of blame, the walls of taking everything personal. Am I willing to go into that and take a look at that? Am I willing to look at the common manifestations of living a life on self-will? Am I willing to look at the rage and anger that I'm still walking around with? Am I willing to look at all that fear that I'm walking around with? Am I willing to look at the harms I've caused, not only sexually, but financially, emotionally, and physically? Am I willing to get that on paper and have a conversation about that stuff? Am I willing to do that? Am I willing to look at the unhealthy dependencies I put on you to make me feel good, especially women? And am I willing to look at the unreal expectations that I walk around with? This idea of playing God, this idea of I'm in charge, this idea that I think I can get you to do what I want you to do to make me feel good. We talk about that in the third step, the director, right? I put conditions on every relationship I've ever been in. And if you do what I want for me, guess what? I feel good. And if you don't, I'm pissed off. It's that simple. So I get off my knees after doing a third step prayer. I've been in a million prayer circles at this point in AA, but this is the first time I ever got on my knees and held another man's hands. And as he said that prayer, he knew the prayer. I didn't know the prayer. 5 years sober, I didn't know the third step prayer. I read it out of the book, but I could feel something. I could feel the spirit of him coming into me. And for some reason, when I got off my knees, I was willing to go to any length to get free. And I did that inventory like we talk about. I started to look at those common manifestations, got it all on paper, and then I had the most powerful day of my life, other than my two children being born. And that was my original fifth step. And I'll never forget, I was in for a long talk. And I gave this guy my life. I knew, and I was very clear on that, I'll never get through that archway. I'll never get through that door with a secret in my back pocket. I have to lay it on the table and trust this guy. I had to do something that I thought was a weakness because I come from the streets, but was really strengthened in disguise. I had to become vulnerable to another man. I had to let another man into my life. And this guy, Bill Grace, was the guy. And he took me through that process, and I did that fifth step. And I always like to talk about that hour we take afterwards, because a miracle happened for a guy like me. I do this thing in his apartment. I go out to this place called Liberty State Park. I didn't go home, put the book on the shelf, and take it down. I went to this place called Liberty State Park. It's a state park in New Jersey on the Hudson River that they were just building. So they still had those old piers from the old warehouse days. And I walked out on this pier, and I sat down, and I opened the book to 75. I read that paragraph. I read those first five proposals, all the stones properly. Asked myself all those questions, when all of a sudden I looked to my right. Boom, right in front of me, right there, a quarter mile away, was the Statue of Liberty. Looked across the river. Boom, right in front of me, the World Trade Center, both towers. Looked to my left. Boom, Ellis Island. Why am I saying boom? Ellis Island. Marion has an effect on me. It's that Seattle Seahawk football I had to listen to. But there's Ellis Island. Symbols of freedom. And here I sat as a 32-year-old man with tears coming down my eyes. I could feel the arms of God wrapped around me for the first time in my life. And for the first time in my life, I think I'm going to be okay. For the first time in my life, I feel part of rather than separate from. And all I needed to do is to bring you in and allow you to come into my life and allow you to help me rather than thinking I have to do this all on my own. It was an unbelievable day, but then I fell for the biggest trap we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell prey to comfortability. And all of a sudden, All right, the game's at 12. We've got another hour. All right, I'll give you the 15 minutes for the ride home. I fell for the biggest trap we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell prey to comfortability. All of a sudden, overtime became more important. All of a sudden, coaching baseball became more important. Coaching girls basketball became more important. Now, nothing wrong with that at all. but it overtook my primary purpose. I always like to say, if I took the boat out into the ocean by my house, you know, and pointed it east, like you guys, I see the most beautiful thing every morning, the sunrise, right? I could be out on that boat, I could see the curvature of the earth. But what I don't see is that I'm drifting from town to town to town because I'm only looking one way. And I don't see that I'm being disconnected from God again. I don't see that self-will and riot is back in my life again. I'm under the delusion because I go to meetings, I sponsor a few guys, do a little bit of service work that I'm okay, when the truth is, at 10 years, I'm not okay. But I can't see that. And I make a decision, a bad decision, a real bad decision. Because at 10 years, me and my wife are having a lot of problems at home. A lot of fighting, a lot of financial stuff, a lot of everything stuff. And we're always fighting. And a woman in AA gives me a little bit of attention. I fall hook, line, and sinker for that. And I walk out of my marriage, and I walk into the arms of a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous who understands. And I blow up my life in AA at 10 years without a drink. And I tell you that not because I want to tell you that. I tell you that because that's the truth of my story. The truth of my story is, man, I didn't want to do that, but I did that. And worse yet, I'm looking at an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, and they're looking at their father, and they see me getting pulled out of the house by cops. Because on July 8th, 1997, is my son's birthday. He's 5 years old. July 9th is my daughter's birthday. She's 8 years old. July 10th, the cops are pulling me out of the house, 1997, because of my anger and the rage and my alcoholism taking over all over again. And I walk out of this house never to go back again. And I blow up my life. I'm the guy that builds a beautiful spiritual structure for me and my family, and I tear it down with a senseless series of sprees. And let me tell you, you don't need to be drinking to blow up your life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just sponsor people. You'll find that out. So that really what happened. Living that double life. 10 years, 11 years. Tell my sponsor about 20% of what's really going on. And that 13 years without a drink in my hands, I understand what Dr. Bob talks about when he says he was stuck between a rock and a hard place because I didn't want to drink, but I needed a drink because of the way I was living in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the double life. And I walked into a bar one day, you know, and I'm fed up. And I asked the bartender, I said, bartender, put a drink on the bar. I'm 13 years sober, not telling anyone where I'm at. No one knows what's going on in my life. You know, I'm the guy that shows up to your group. Hey, Jimmy, how's everything? Great, because my veins are about to explode. But here I am. I'm in a bar, and I order that drink, and I'm staring that drink down. Drink it. Don't drink it. Drink it. Don't drink it. When all of a sudden, you know, the hand goes around the glass. And when the bartender pulls back the glass, I look at the bartender, and he just happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. What are you doing? Apparently throwing my life away. And I took my tail and I walked into walked out of that bar. Let me tell you about the human ego, how it will resurface in no time flat. Two weeks later, I'm in a meeting in my town, which I never really went to. And this gentleman right here was giving a workshop. And this guy's too good to be true. I mean, you know, 2 weeks early, I want to kill myself. 2 weeks later, I'm judging another alkie in a meeting of AA. Isn't it amazing how the ego just... But I asked him politely to sponsor me at the end of that meeting. He'll tell you that I had him in a headlock saying, you will sponsor me. But I was dying. I'm dying. I'm dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And how many of us in here are sitting right now with secrets in our pocket? Not talking about the things that are going on, right? And what this gentleman did for me was what any alcoholic would do for another alcoholic. He started to take me through this process again and to uncover, discover, and discard the things that are blocking me. Somewhere along that lines, I just got self-will run riot. There was no God in my life. I'm God, right? I was doing all that stuff. And, you know, little by little, my life got reconstructed. I went through a divorce. And, you know, I'm not going to bore you with a lot more, but, you know, just the adversities of life. There's not a person in this room who won't have their time, in a barrel, right? We're all going to go through something, right? You know, I don't know how long I was sober. I went through a divorce. Well, before I even went through the divorce, December 6, 1999, I was in a horrific accident on the job. And I got retired on that day at the age of 40 years old or 41 years old, whatever it was. I've had, 12 back operations, 3 knee replacements. I've had 40 surgeries in the last 20 years. I'm really 5'8", but with all the metal I'm in, 6'4". It's a miracle how that happened, you know. But the truth of the matter is I went through the ringer with all that stuff. You know, a lot of physical pain. I walked around Alcoholics Anonymous for 4 years with a walker. I couldn't walk. And it's just a miracle how my life has been kind of repaired since that stuff, how God has healed me in that way. You know, I went through a divorce with that ex-wife, now my ex-wife, you know, and then I met my wife, Mary Beth. You know, I'm the guy that said, I'll never get married again. And then I met Mary Beth, right? And Mary Beth was a member of the World Trade Center AA group. There was a meeting in the World Trade Center on a daily basis. And on 9/11, obviously, you guys know, her home group perished. A lot of people got killed in her home group. And she used to invite us to come up and do a little pitch, you know, like this. And then, you know, a pitch became a cup of coffee, it became lunch, became a proposal. And we'll be married 20 years in 2 weeks or something like that. The 20th. God doing for me what I can never do for myself, you know. How's that happen, right? And we've had this blessed life, you know. You know, like I said, I went through that. I went through, like any of us, money problems, financial problems, you name it. We all have those problems, you know. And, you know, and I like to tell you a little bit about my mother, you know, before I kind of wrap this up. You know, my mom was a city girl when she met my old man. And, you know, never drove a car. You know, my mom was a Jane Fonda workout freak. For you older, you might have to Google that, young people, but this thing is a VCR, you stuff it in, you ladies put on your leotards and you dance into the, used to say dance into the 90s or whatever that was. I think that was Richard Simmons, but my mom was always in phenomenal shape, you know, and at 90 years old, the doctors come to us and said, your mother needs a knee replacement. And we're like, you're out of your mind. She's 90 years old. And the doctor said to us, she's in better shape than her 5 kids put together. So my mom had a knee replacement at 90 years old. Now, she was slipping a little bit. But any of you medical people in here, when you get put under anesthesia at that age, she went off the deep end real quick. And she got full-blown dementia. I tell you this story for a couple of reasons. Number one is, you know, the power of God in all of this. You know, becoming the parent of your parent is a really weird thing. You know, my old man died. He was just, boom, boom, he was dead. 63 years old, 3 years younger than I am right now. But then we had to take care of my mother, you know, and my mother didn't know anything. Matter of fact, we were sitting at the table one day. She was like 90, 91 years old. We're having lunch, me, Mary Beth, my mother. My mother looks at me. She says, where were you? What? Where were you? What are you talking about? I walked the streets looking for my son for 2 years. Where were you? And my ego was something inside of me wanted to respond to that. Like, I made mom, I made, you know, amends to your restitution to you 27 years ago, living amends all this time, taking care of you. But God just said, shut up. Just shut up. You don't need to justify anything. And 2 seconds later, my mom didn't even know who she was talking to. And it got so bad, she would wander the streets at 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't even know how she got out of her house. And the cops would find her. I don't know where I live. So we eventually had to put her into an assisted living place. And that's when the pandemic happened. And she's in an assisted living, and the whole place gets COVID. And my mother passed away from COVID. But I want to tell you about that day. So I just had my third knee replacement. Yes, 3 knee replacements. Yes, I know, I only got 2 knees. Yes. These are the tough questions I'm asked sometimes. I got a joke behind that, but it's dirty, so I won't even say it. Has to do something with an implant, but I'll let you your mind think about that one. So anyway, I come out, I get a phone call from the hospice nurse, and she calls me and goes, get here. Your mom's going to die any minute. And, you know, so I get to the, it's only like 2 miles away. I get to the assisted living place, and I meet the hospice nurse. And back then, in the beginning, remember, you had to take a test, put the PPE on. I haven't seen my mother in months. You know, and my sisters are hitting me up, FaceTime mommy, FaceTime mommy. I think we were all in denial, maybe. You know, I think I'm going to go see the 60-year-old Jane Fonda mom. And so I'm just about to go in, and a hospice nurse grabs me. She goes, I want to let you know something. Your mom's not going to be able to open her eyes or speak, but she could hear you. And then she pulled the curtain back, and what was laying in bed was a skeleton, my mom. And I walked up to my mother, and I grabbed her hand, said, hi, Mom, it's Jimmy. and her chest exploded with oxygen. The son has come home. Does God hear our prayers? I don't know how long I've been saying this prayer of St. Francis in AA. I think maybe since I've been introduced to that prayer, reading 11 step out of the 12 and 12 one day, and it just became part of my prayer life, that prayer. Our good friend Don Majors used to say it all the time, to love, comfort, and understand. Love, comfort, and understand. To love, comfort, and understand. I was given a consideration once by a sponsor, and he asked me, Jimmy, do you look at the people in your life, the situations in your life, and the circumstances of your life through the lens of a character defect or through the eyes of God? I've always looked at everything through a lens of a character defect, with anger, with fear, with envy, with jealousy, with whatever the character defect is. That's how I looked at life. But now I'm starting to look at life because of this transformation, because of these 12 steps, because of the power of God in my life. I'm looking at this stuff differently. To love, comfort, and understand. With love and forgiveness. If love and tolerance is our code, is it really? Is it really? Do I look at things with compassion and forgiveness and love? And I started to look back on that situation on that day. And God was doing for me what I could never do for myself. And as I let go of my mom's hand and said, go back to Dad, he's waiting for you in heaven. You know, I walked out of there, the nurse called me an hour later and says, your mom's passed. But it was profound. And everyone who's sitting here who's lost their parents, you know what that's like. There's a hole. Never gets filled. I don't believe it gets filled. Maybe it gets filled a little bit. But there's a hole. My mom did everything for me. She bailed me out of every jail. She did everything for me. There was times when I would say, how the hell did she get money to scrap up to get me out of jail this time? And I took advantage of all that. But my mom was always there for me. And it was just another point of, the point of the story is, you know, just that God was doing for me that day what I could never do for myself. And guess what? The evidence is all around us. The evidence is all around us. Of people who have gone through hard times, good times, whatever the time is, whether it's financial, whether it's a death in the family, whether it's whatever it is. And guess what? We have the unfair advantage here. Because we have people in this room right now who have had experience going through whatever you're going through right now. I just need to tap into those people and bring God into that with me. So really, that was like the last year. You know, God takes away one life, and all of a sudden, my daughter comes home and says, Dad, you're going to be a grandfather for the first time. And that little Mila, she's two now. Some of you might see me on Facebook. She's the joy of our life. And then my son, you know, 10 weeks ago, we had our grandson. So now we have two grandkids. And, you know, I remember the old guys used to say, wait till you have grandkids. I'm like, yeah, I'm sure it's going to be fun. I didn't know how much fun you were talking about. And when you can hand them back at the end of the day. There you go. What's that on her? I think it's ice cream we had at 8 o'clock this morning. Oh, that's the soda that she doesn't drink in your house. Why is my kid up to 3 in the morning? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. But I'll end on this. You know, you old timers made me a promise, and we make promises to everyone. Sometimes it sounds like good lines you throw out at meetings sometimes, right? But the old timers used to say, if you come all the way in and sit all the way down, those feelings of isolation and loneliness will leave you. And they'll be replaced with friendships and relationships that. And I look in this room, there's a lot of people I know, and there's a few people I know in this room and around this country, and because of, you know, the virtual platform, people around the world, really, the friends that I have because of this in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and all I'm asked to do is, you know, for fun and free, to give this away, you know, and, you know, and it's unbelievable the path that God has really put me on, you know. Like this group, John was telling me the story. You know, John, he's a funny guy, this guy John, right? At dinner last night, pulls out his phone and goes, these were all the speakers we had over the last 20 years, and they were all really good. Yeah. What does that mean? But in 2005, we sat in my living room with a group of 12 people, and like Bill Wilson hammering out on the anvil of experience when he wrote The Traditions, we wanted to start a group in my home, my hometown, a big book meeting. And so 12 of us got together, we came up with a format, we went to prayer, we prayed that 30 people would show up to our first meeting. And on the first night that we had our first meeting, 175 people showed up. Ditch the tables, we need more chairs. And that group now, well, 19 years sober, right behind you guys, we've been averaging 200 to 300 people every Sunday night for a big book study over the last, like, 19 years. And, you know, we have a study group, and then we do a traditions workshop, we do a concepts workshop. We really pride ourselves on a three legacy group, you know. And that first year, we had to go from a meeting to a group. I hope you know the difference. And we needed a GSR, and they said to me at the time, said, Jimmy, why don't you be the GSR? And in my head, I said, I don't do that crap. Excuse me. Now, that sounds kind of weird, saying that. And the reason why I said that is because I was afraid to be a GSR, because I'm 19 years sober at the time, and I don't know what a GSR means. I'm an active guy in a group, but outside the group, I don't know that stuff. But you know, God does for me what I could never do for myself. All of a sudden, my hand starts to go up. All of a sudden, I have this conversation. Maybe some of you guys have had this conversation. What are you doing? You know? And I became the GSR. Little did I know that God was putting me on a path that I would never knew was going to happen. And I go to this thing called the Northeast Regional Service Assembly in Maryland. You guys got the Southeast Regional AA Service Assembly. And I go to this thing, and I meet two guys, two old-timers from my neighborhood, who I think are just two old guys from my neighborhood. One's a past Northeast Regional Trustee, the other one's a past United States Trustee at Large and a delegate. And they take me under their wing. And this one guy, John Q, becomes my a good friend of mine, and he gives me the service manual, another piece of fine literature to read, guys. He goes, I only want you to read one thing in here, and it's on S20 in the old manual. It says, why do we have a conference? Why do we do the things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous? It's not to ensure our sobriety. That newcomer that shows up here on Thursday nights for the West Side Men's Group, I know what you guys do. You grab that guy and you pull him into the middle of the herd. I know you women in here that have your home group. When a young lady shows up or an old lady shows up, I know what you do with your groups. But this isn't about the person who's in here today. It's about the guy who's out there right now in Plantation, Florida, who just cracked open a bottle of whiskey, ready to wash his day away because he doesn't know what to do with his life. Meanwhile, there's over, 150 guys in here that have a solution to his problem. Right now, in Plantation, Florida, is a single mom who can't wait to put those kids down and crack open a bottle of wine and wash her day away. Right now, in your local hospital, and every hospital from here to New Jersey, there's a baby being born destined for alcoholism. And what I started to understand is I have a little bit more of a responsibility than just showing up at an AA meeting, drinking a bad cup of coffee, and sitting in a metal chair and complaining about the sad state of the nation. That I got to get a little bit more active than I have. And God started to put me on this path because our real goal here, why we gather, is because we need to carry the message to the alcoholic who's still out there that doesn't know we're in here. And what I started to do was I started to get involved in committees. I started to do a lot of different things I never did before. I started to go down that inverted triangle, became a DCM, became the area chair, became the alternate delegate. I rotated out 2 years ago as the delegate to the General Service Conference. I had an experience that was quite remarkable. I was the closest delegate to Brooklyn, New York. I'm the only delegate that drove to the General Service Conference in my second year. And as I drove to Brooklyn, New York, I made a decision to drive through the streets where I grew up. And you know when you're a little kid, you look at your old neighborhood or where you grew up and you think everything is real, real big? I drove through that city and I'm like, man, things shrunk. Things are really small here. And I drove past that first bar that I drank in at 15 years old, Wally's. Wally's Beer. That's what you signed, Wally's Beer. I drove through the streets where I would walk for 2 years, aimlessly. Drove past that house that I was raised in, where the violence went on. And I had to pull over it, because I couldn't stop crying. I couldn't stop crying. Because just like when I was in Los Angeles, to go from that to this and everything in between, how does that happen to a guy like me? How does that happen to a guy or a girl like you? It's only a miracle. And I couldn't stop crying because of the gratitude I have for Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 90 days sober in New Jersey, and I'll end on this, when I was 90 days sober, and the way we do celebrations, we don't do the chip system in New Jersey. We do 90-day bindings, and then we do yearly celebrants. So 90 days, you would go to the podium, and you'd be dressed like this no matter what. The old timers instilled wearing a suit to the podium, wear a dress to the podium, show your respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stood at a podium just like this. Richie Schnorr, the guy that 12-stepped me in Newark Airport, was standing next to me. My mother and father were in the front row. And I couldn't see them because the smoke was so heavy that I knew what their kneecaps looked like, so I knew they were there. And Richie held his 90-day pin. The 90-day pin had a little dot in the middle, it had a G on top, and had AA on the bottom. And this is the promise he made. And this is the promise we make for you, Humberto, and anyone who's counting days, or anyone who's going through a hard time, whether you've had 10 years, 20 years, or 30 years. We're not immune to life's problems, right? We know that. But this is what they told me. Jimmy, you're that little insignificant dot in the middle. But if you could put one hand in God, the G, and one hand in AA, and get involved in the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, to get in the middle of this deal, you'll never have a hand to pick up a drink. They weren't lying to me now, and I'm not lying to you now. One hand in God, one hand in Alcoholics Anonymous, get in the middle of this deal, and you'll have a life beyond your wildest dreams. That's all I have. Thanks, Jeff.